All right. Why don't we start with a moment of silence and tap into the power that got us here and keeps us here. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Oh, before I forget now, we have the Merton Prayer. There has been a request from some people for the Merton Prayer, and there's a stack of them up here if you would like. Matter of fact, I'd like to read it if that's all right. My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. We can just like end there. No. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end. Nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think that I am following your will does not mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore will I trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, I've seen people pull on that word sanity. Like, I'm not insane. I'm thinking, dude, what program are you in? Drinking and not drinking, have we seen insanity in our lives? Which incidentally proves the lie once again to the fact that the alcohol is causing my insanity. I've done worse things sober, I hate to admit to you, than I did drunk. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Because there's something wrong with me. I was sitting in my chair 2-3 days ago, and I just had this thought come to me. And the thought was, I'm abnormal. And it gave me this peace inside. So I said it again, you know, if one's good. I'm abnormal. And I need God to restore me to sanity. I need God for everything. Now, therefore I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. So I had 25 years in advertising. And I got to the end of that road, and I couldn't find work, and my last bid for work was to go to work in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I am a Western American, and I was living on the East Coast, and I had no idea what was in store for me. Exemplar Gatsia. There are Lobsterman's bars in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. You don't go into that bar unless you're a lobsterman. You understand? These are like cowboys. And, you know, and it went on and on and on. So I lived in Dover, New Hampshire, and I would wake up in the morning in Dover, New Hampshire, and I would drive through Kittery, Maine, into Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I was spun upside down. I was a stranger in a strange land. Like, if we think America is one country, we're kidding ourselves. Our country is many countries. If you don't believe me, go to Texas, which is where I went to school. But New England is its own country. And I didn't know that. And so I would go and I remember eating my alphabets because I'm a writer in advertising, so I'm eating alphabets, whatever. Okay, so I'm eating my alphabet cereal, and I'm watching a claymation show on TV in the morning before I go to work. And it's Abraham and Sarah and Lot, and they're in the sandstorm, and Sarah's on the back of the donkey, and Abraham's leading, and she's like, tell me, Abraham, why are we here? Oh, God told us to be here. That's why we're in this sandstorm, getting our crap knocked out of us. And I'm eating my alphabets and watching this show. And I got to go to work in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And I'm dying inside. I've come up off a suicide attempt. I'm upside down. And I can't believe, I mean, I can barely speak English, much less write it. I was absolutely burned to a crisp inside. And there was a lady who lived in Brunswick, Maine. And her name is
Mary.
Mary Thayer. And Mary Thayer would take us in on the weekend. My wife would drive me up there. And we would stay with Mary Thayer. And she was a hospice worker in addition to her job. So she's dealing with people who are in grief. And my life has fallen in on me like I've never experienced it ever. The dark night of the soul. Okay? And she would give me these pamphlets, I am a stranger in a strange land. I would get up in the morning, drive in, pull into an abandoned cannery in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and cry like a baby. I would dry my eyes and I would go into that work. And these were the meanest people I ever worked with in my life. They had less fun working than anybody I'd ever met. And 5 months later, I was fired. And I deserved to be. I was just gone. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. If you've ever been in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, there's the Portsmouth Naval Prison in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and it looks like a Tim Burton structure. And it's like this gloomy, it's like the weather is centered over and it's always black clouds. And if you were in the Marine Corps or in the Navy and you screwed up, you would end up in the Portsmouth Naval Prison. And it was like really bad scene that was closed. So I had this visual. I'm communicating to you something because I think it's enormously important to understand that God is not Santa Claus. God is brilliance itself. And he's going to do in me and for me whatever is necessary to pull me through. Okay? Now, I was so screwed up I could not walk across the Piscataqua River Bridge because I wanted to throw myself in it so badly. I'm major screwed up. Are you getting the picture? And I remember sitting out on a park bench, and it's a drizzle because it's on the edge of the United States. We're on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean. You can't run any farther than Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I'm there. And it's a drizzle going on, and I'm being mugged for my lunch by a seagull. And I'm crying. And I looked up, and I said, God, I thought you loved me. I thought you loved me. What the hell am I doing here? And I'm looking at the Portsmouth Naval Prison. I'm hanging on by my fingernails, and I stood up in that park, and I said, if this is what it takes for you to rid me of the poisonous nature of the disease that I carry, bring it on. Bring it on. Right here. Right now, we're going to do this thing because I am not going to leave you. Because you're all I have. And I'd heard Merton's prayer. And I'd heard the saying that God writes straight with crooked lines. So, how deadly is the disease of alcoholism that it takes these kinds of things to straighten me out? I think it's very deadly. Now, I'm going to tell you something, and it may or may not mean anything to you, but I have been in the dark night of the soul for over 35 years, and I'm still in it now. And the only reason I would share that with you is because of Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa had written these letters expressing her distance from God for all the marvelous things she has done and did on earth, that she had no sense of God's presence. She really didn't feel that connection. It wasn't this emotional trip. It was a conviction in her soul that you're God and I'm not leaving you. I don't care what. Am I communicating? Because we think, I did, that happy, joyous, and free meant happy, joyous, and free. Well, my freedom has come in this way that I never expected. 25 years doing advertising, and now I make custom cowboy boots. That's what I do for a living. What? And I paint these pictures. I'm going to actually wear a shirt tomorrow that has one of my icons on the back, just so I can show you. Because, not for any bragging, but I want to show you what God can do. Making cowboy boots has between 80 and 300 steps of precision. It's really the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And I remember one night being in my shop, which is in my garage. We converted it over to a boot shop. And I'm being in the shop, and there's these machines. I got two sewing machines that are 5 feet tall. And they sew the soles onto the boots, okay? And because this craft is pretty much dead, there are no technicians to work on these machines. And I'm not a mechanical engineer. It's 11:30 at night, my boots are due the next day. And the machine makes this horrible sound and spits a nut right into my hand like a cat coughing up a fur ball. And I'm screwed. That's it. That's the end. My wife's asleep, and I stood out of my shop and I screamed at God, I will not leave you. I will not leave you. You're all I have. I think that's a man who's ready to take some steps. What do you think? Let's take this seriously. We are a people of worth. We have immense value, even if it's just to be a friend to somebody. Mother Teresa said, if you want to change the world, people were always asking, you want to change the world? You know what her answer was in one case? Smile. Just smile. It makes a huge difference. That may be my job, just to smile. I was going in to get a guy that I sponsor and his wife were getting married recently, and the only witnesses to it were my wife and I. And so we're down in this beautiful church in downtown Denver. And as we were walking there, I did exactly what I told you. I smiled at this guy and he stopped. He was a homeless man, and he looked at me and he said, do you know why I stopped? And I said, no. And he said, because you smiled at me. And I was taught that one of the cruelest things about being a beggar is that you are invisible. I was thinking the other day of a woman, a young girl, beautiful. I'd say late teens, early 20s. My wife and I were in Chicago, coming back from visiting our daughter in Springfield, Illinois. And we were walking on the sidewalk, and I heard this voice say, don't step on me. It was her. Her life was completely zeroed out. And she told me, don't step on me. God, how low do you have to get in your life? We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I tell that story about being ragged out like that. I went from making six figures to painting apartments for a guy. We came back from New Hampshire. We moved back to Denver after I got fired appropriately. And I am painting painting apartments for a guy that I sponsor, and I'm riding to work on a bicycle after making six figures. And so humility is the antidote for the outrageous self-centeredness that I suffer from. And, right? And so the training can be a bitch. And the big joke between my wife and I is, if this is the training, what's the job? Impatience. If I'm not willing to suffer, I can't get well. Why? Because it's going to go counter to everything inside me. I have this, we get it in movies. This is a worthwhile life. You can ride a mountain bike over the Grand Canyon, I don't know what all, right? And if I'm not doing that, then I'm a failure. If I'm some poor schlep spending 6 days a week on a workbench trying to make boots that fit and have some beauty, then you know what I mean? I've disappeared. We have a monastery right here. My wife and I live in a monastery. Our home. We wake up, we pray, we sing the psalms just like the monks do, and we go to work. I put my forehead on my bench, and I said, God, please bring beauty and harmony to this work. You are beauty and harmony. And I trust in you. And that's how I start working my day. I work under a crucifix. It's my faith. That's how we live. I'm going like, dude, it's like being in prison. I'm serious. I don't know what the weather is outside. I'm in here working this way. I'm going to be 70 years old in January, and I'm working in a monastery making cowboy boots because God told me so. Do you remember that song? I went up on the mountain because you asked me to. If we're going to give our lives to God, be prepared to have your life interfered with. Right? We give our lives to God and we miss our flight and we turn to God and say, what's that? Right? My wife read something the other day, and I don't know where she read it actually, and it said, life is it accidental or intentional? Is life accidental or intentional? Is it possible that it is intentional from God? Or is it just random? And my faith is that it's intentional. So when the machine breaks and I can't do it for the next morning, I'm with him. Whatever you wear, like me being with that pilot at 31,000 feet. Wherever you're going, boss, that's where I'm going. Win, lose, or draw. I was talking with somebody recently about boot making. Can you make a living at it? My wife and I make just enough money every month to pay our bills, but it's been going on like that for 13, almost 14 years. Just enough money. Well, how much money do we need? You know what the answer is to how much money is enough, don't you? Just enough so I don't have to trust God. Right? If I got enough money, baby, I'm golden. I got it. Right? That's why rich people are so absolutely threatened in their lives, because it's a lie. This one is like each month. This is my response to the second step. I just thought I'd characterize the God that I follow. We have just enough each month. When I was making six figures, we lived in a three-story Victorian mansion with a swimming pool, a carriage house, and all the whoop-de-doo. I bought antique cars. Oh, yeah. I love antique cars. And I worried more about money there than I do now. And it says we will have no fear of economic, what's it say?
Insecurity.
Boom. It's just there. And what's cool is I'm married to the neatest lady ever because she's in it with me. She walks this and she encourages me and I encourage her. This is what I've been given by this God who had me with the Seagull and the Portsmouth Naval Prison. I got this at an Al-Anon meeting at the Fellowship of the Spirit Conference in the mountains of Colorado. This Al-Anon said, it is better to bear the pain of waiting for God than to bear the pain of knowing you didn't. You know, and we say, what's that expression? don't leave before the miracle happens. And the way I receive all of these things is, man, you must be talking to somebody else. You think I'm special, I'm just another brick in the wall. You know what I mean? That's the way I receive information. It's no. You are very, very, very important, or you wouldn't be here. God's kingdom is not complete without you, or you would not be here. So if that's true, then it says, how can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us continually. Now, we think that, like, so. When I was in Catholic high school, they gave us all these proofs for the existence of God that have nothing to do with Scripture. Okay, these are just like common sense if you're looking at it. And they were really cool because they were all done in Latin. And so here's this one. I think there's a group by this name, but anyway, Deus Ex Machina. God from the machine. If there's a clock works, there must be a clock maker. So we see the planets doing all their thing, and we see all this going on. If there's a clock works, there must be a clock maker. So you and I are pieces of that clock, or we wouldn't be here. Trouble is, we all want to be the minute hand or the hour hand. And if we all did that, the clock wouldn't work. So I figured, you know, Bill Gates was given his part of the clock, and I was given my part of the clock over in my garage. So what? We are equals. We are all valuable. You know what I'm saying? So in the pecking order of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we say, oh, dude, that guy has been like, whoa. What? Some of us serve in that way. Some of us serve in another way. And it all counts. It all counts. The trick is to do it with God. Right? If we're going to clean up this place, we do it with God. And that's how we live our lives. And that's how we become attractive. And this is a program of attraction. And we are attracted to each other, which means we're being attracted to the God in each other. When I started this thing, I thought, there's no God, and if there is a God, he sends people like me to hell. Because I broke a few rules. And so I had to come up. They said, you can have any God you want. You can have the God of your understanding. So here's what I wrote down on a piece of paper. I'm talking about brand new sober. I want a God who understands the connection between things. Because to me, in my psyche, which incidentally does not mean brain, it's the Greek word for soul. In my psyche, the world was like after the Big Bang Theory. It was coming apart. I remember sitting in the last days of my drinking, sitting in my living room looking out the window saying, why aren't those people out there killing each other? Because there was such war and chaos inside of me. So everything was disconnected. That's why I wanted a God who could see the connection between things. It was my understanding that in some studies that the baby laying in its cradle looks up at this and these and does not understand that these are connected to this and this and this. It's all disparate. And that's the way the world was for me. I wanted a God who could put that together so I could have some integrity, so I could come together because I was a shattered mirror. And I wondered why I liked to braid my wife's hair, because it's all connection. And incidentally, then she cut her hair in sobriety, and I went to find a leather shoelace that I could braid just to keep my hands busy. I love braids. I love the way they look. Braids are beautiful. And I went to find that, and I walked into a place called the Leather Factory, and I saw all of this going on. And we needed gifts for speakers at the Colorado Fellowship of the Spirit. And I learned how to tool and how to work leather. And that's where I started out on this trail to becoming a bootmaker. And I love the smell of leather. And it's the long and winding road that God is putting us on. He's got all of us on that road. Do you see what I'm saying? And it can be a leather shoelace that leads to the next thing, that leads to the next thing. So God is very interesting. God is very interesting. I'm just going to tell you that I can't believe this. I am afraid of heights, and I'm afraid of airplanes and flying. I really am frightened. And I've had a jet strapped to my ass for 41 years. Talk about a sense of humor. Anyway, so we're in, there was, Don Pritz was this guy who's now dead, and he was very, very influential to a lot of people around the world. And he would just like get so many invitations to speak that he'd just divvy them out to us. And so one of them, he said, Mickey, here's the way he would do it. You're going to speak in on the Pine Ridge Reservation in Rapid City, South Dakota. And so there were like, I say it this way, but it's not, 10 little Indians. But anyway, there were 10 Indians who wanted to have a powwow and have alcoholics come in to speak. And so my wife and I flew out to South Dakota. I'll tell you a story there because it was so wonderful. The Native Americans would stand up to share, and they would plant 1 foot here, 1 foot there, and they would just flat tell you the truth, eye bone to eye bone. I was in awe. And I was just like watching this. It was fabulous. 60 people in this thing. And so Marie and I took a break. This is just an aside because I think it's beautiful. But anyway, we took a break and we went for a walk and this ambulance came flying by us. Now, the reservation is dry. So if you're going to get a drink, you've got to go off the reservation and buy the booze and, you know, come back and drink it. So whatever was happening, this ambulance flies by us. We go back and there's this guy named Tuffy. And Tuffy was there and he said, you know, my nephew just went off the reservation to get some alcohol, and he totaled his car. And he said, I just held him on the flight line. Waited for the flight to life, for life. And he said, the priest came and gave him last rites, and the meters went up on his heart while he was getting last rites. And then he flatlined and died. And he said, I just didn't want to be alone. And he came back to share with us. So anyway, we go from there, and it's like April 14th. I haven't done my taxes. We're sitting on the ground. I remember this. I haven't done my taxes. We're on the ground, and a blizzard's going sideways at the airport, and they close it. And so we go back into Rapid City, South Dakota, where we've flown in. And we get back on the flight line. And the irony of this is I got a brother who is a Navy pilot. My dad was a pilot in the Air Force. And here I am, like, shaking like a leaf on a fuzzy tree. But anyway, we're sitting on the ground, and there's like a 50-mile-an-hour crosswind. We are in mild turbulence on the ground. And I just can't take it. I'm just terrified. And I don't know what to reach out. I'm just going to tell you this story. You do with it as you please. And the Blessed Mother, Mary, came and started talking to me. And I'm sitting on this airplane, and she said, Mickey, you just stick with me. And she says, I'm going to be with you as this airplane takes off, and I'll be with you all the way home. And I'm going to tell you what's going on, and I'm going to take care of you. And I'm going, okay. And we start to take off, and she starts to talk to me. And she hasn't stopped talking to me for all the years since she was talking to me coming in here yesterday. What kind of spiritual help is available to us? There's a temptation in us, is there not, to scoff at all this because it seems beyond anything that could happen to us? I'm not selling Bibles, but Jesus said, the first shall be last, and the last shall be first. Near as I can figure, we qualify for the second part of that equation. Don't discount the spiritual help that is available to us. It doesn't have to be voices. It doesn't have to be like that. But when we see our lives raise up, if we follow the yellow brick road out of this book, follow what it tells us to do, our lives will raise up. Maybe not in our estimation. You may have to spend a few days sitting on a bench being mugged by a seagull. Or you may have to spend years in it, but it's really worth it. I guess that's what I have to share. Nate?
Thanks a lot. Thank
you.
Yeah. So I just want to get the turbine spinning, as you say. I'd just like to read a little piece out of the book on page 53, which for me is the essence of the second step as I understand it currently. Right at the middle of the page, it says, "When we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? Arrived at this point, we were squarely confronted with the question of faith. We couldn't duck the issue." And I swear I didn't even realize that line was in there for like the first 5 years I was sober. It's scary. It's much scarier than the other proposition, right? You know, do I believe or am I even willing to believe? Can do that. That's easy, right? Sure, I'll crack the door. Oh, clearly. I mean, and it's such a nice thing that our steps are in order. I don't suggest trying to work them out of order, because they build a nice little structure, one on top of the other. For me, having had a thorough first step, like we talked about before, I'm then able to move forward to the second step and consider that proposition. Because if I've identified the desperation and the powerlessness, and if I realize just how screwed I actually am by the end of my first step, this question is much easier for me to consider. Right? If I still have ideas as to why I'm better at playing God than God, I'm not there. And unfortunately, we cannot bring about the willingness to answer that question for anybody other than ourselves internally. And that can be frustrating. It's frustrating for me at times where and it was presented to me like this. Over the last 12 months, if you had to answer one way or the other, there's no gray area in this, would you say that in your life God has been everything or has he been nothing? Everybody that I've ever asked that question to, the first time I tried to answer it, always tries to paint a gray answer to that black or white question. Yeah, 90-10, 50-50, 40-60. But the question is all or nothing, right? Was God everything or was he nothing? I can't get the words to roll off my tongue that God was nothing. There's almost a disloyalty that comes about it in me. It makes me feel like I failed. Good news. That's what we're after here, right? The more humility that can be brought up in me through considerations like that, because every time I've answered that question, the answer has been nothing, right? Because, I mean, if I'm on one end of the spectrum or the other, I've never got to a trip through the steps and been able to say God was everything for the last year. I've been just cruising smooth. I'm way too broken. And it's a blessing, really. Because why else would I have the opportunity to go back and re-examine the first step? Because for me, the things that come up through that second part that we talked about, to be able to take that into a second step and really consider this, I'm looking at the proposition that God is either everything or else he is nothing. That applies to the areas of my life that have been exposed real time in the second half of that first step, right? What areas of my life am I still holding on to? What areas do I refuse to let God manage? And can I say God's everything? A lot of the time I can't, because I'm still not willing to let go of the reins. I wish I was. My life would be a whole lot less eventful, I'm sure. It'd probably be pretty smooth if I actually just trusted God to the way that I aspire to. The good news is that
must be this tape.
It's gotta be. But anyway, it's just until I experience desperation, and I mean personally, not just the understanding of desperation as it's outlined in our text, like to understand what desperation is as it relates to alcoholism is one thing. But to actually experience that internally and just have the shift where I'm dying and I identify that I am going to die, literally or spiritually, if I don't trust God. Like, I have to be at that place because I can't move forward in these steps if I haven't laid down a solid foundation of desperation. And that goes for the day I came in, right? I mean, it was pretty straightforward to lay down some desperation when I was still, you know, shaking and baking when I first came in. But as I go on, I forget that every time I examine this, I have the opportunity to apply our 12-step process to whatever it is in my life that's actually flaring up that isn't related to alcohol at all, right? And that's where I struggle. That's where, you know, the rubber hits the road, so to speak. And I don't love it. I in fact, a lot of the time, it's terrifying to face the fact that everything? I mean, everything? Let's be honest, right? Who doesn't look at that and say, the alcoholic mind clicks on and says, you can't do anything forever, right? Can I even answer that question? Because that's, again, the next question I have to consider. If my answer was that God's been nothing, in realizing how screwed I am currently, could I aspire for anything other than wanting God to be everything? Normally not. I mean, I can't sit here and be like, my life is in shambles, I'm dying, I'm just in so much pain internally, but I'm still going to just go for the road of God being nothing. It just never happens for me, right? And I'm usually beaten to a pulp through that desperation before that door is presented to me. And I heard early on, like, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, right? And all those the great metaphors of the snake shedding its skin. It's so true because I have a tendency, again, because of my self-defeating core, that I look back and I said, how did I not see that? How did I miss that? How did I not know that I was off track? How do I not trust God? Again, we're not going to say this to anybody. This is right here, right? How did I know? How am I not the AA member that I aspire to be, right? I'm a fraud. I'm packing my bags. I'm out of here. That's usually where it goes pretty quickly, right? I'm gonna have a new identity. I'm gonna leave my family. I'm gonna find a nice igloo and you know, somewhere up on the ice cap and call it a life, right? I wish I was joking a lot of the time. Like I planned second identities at many different stages of my recovery. Go figure, right? But to walk into that darkness is really what it looks like. When I'm proposed with this consideration that God is going to be everything or he's going to be nothing, I was at a retreat actually in New Hampshire a couple of weeks ago, and we were all there was a break in the schedule for everyone to swim. It was on a lake. It was great. And they had another group camp there. It was kids. They were using this giant, I don't even know what it was. It was a giant platform that they could jump off into the water. And these kids were like, I don't know, 10. And every one of them was up, you know, they climb the ladder and they get up there. Every one of them would walk to the edge of it and look over and be like, oh, I can't do it. They'd walk up. They'd try again. They'd go like 6 times before they actually had the energy and the courage to jump off. And I looked to the guys we were with. I said, gentlemen, that is the best analogy for trusting God you will ever see in your life, right? I come to the edge and I'm like, what if he doesn't catch me, right? What if God doesn't have a plan for me? What if I jump and there's nothing there, right? I mean, that's what I live with. That's what's, I could say, oh yeah, I'm all in with God. Let's do this. But the reality is more often than not, I'm scared to death that if I jump and if I trust, he's not going to catch me, right? That's the deepest fear that I have in my core is that God doesn't actually have a plan for Nate Frank, right? I slip through the cracks. Like, I'm not worthy of whatever it is God has in store for the rest of the people. So, to come to the proposition that God is either everything or else he is nothing, what's my choice to be? That's a personal thing, again, right? I have to consider that for myself. Am I going to go all in with God? Or am I going to continue just to try and to squabble, basically, is what it looks like for me. And it's not an easy question to answer. And the darkness, one of the best stories, it's one of my favorites. What we do as we're working our way through this process and being with God and living a life reliant upon God, the story of the caterpillar, right? One of the ugliest creatures on planet Earth, right? No, I mean, if anybody's got a passion for caterpillars, sorry. You'll get where I'm going with this. It's necessary. So, I mean, this caterpillar essentially, you know, goes into the darkness, right? I mean, it literally wraps itself in a cocoon all alone, completely alone, feels completely isolated, darkness. And for me, that's the place I have to go with God to truly be transformed. Into the darkness where nothing is safe. I'm all alone. I feel like I'm dying. And essentially what's happening inside of that cocoon is that caterpillar is being torn limb from limb. And that's what's happening to me spiritually when I go all in with God, it feels like at times. Scary. But what happens on the other end, right? Like, once that process and that transformation is complete, a butterfly emerges, which is one of the most beautiful creatures on planet Earth, right? And we just don't understand, at least I don't understand a lot of the time, that being torn limb from limb, that transformation period is necessary for me to be transformed into what it is that God has for me, right? I will do anything in my power to avoid pain, to avoid discomfort. And more often than not, I will miss out on opportunities to be transformed because I don't want to suffer. Again, like it's been talked about. I don't want to suffer. I came here to be happy, joyous, and free. Anything less than that, you guys are way off track, right? I don't want to. What's the point, right? Why did I didn't get sober to suffer. But the reality is for me is it's not even actual suffering. It's just discomfort, right? It's just me not having an answer all the time. A lot of the time I have no choice but to just be, to be in discomfort. There was a period over the, a couple of years ago maybe not even that, where I had made such a mess. And again, like, I love my wife more than anything. I had made such a mess and drove her so crazy that I was literally convinced she was going to leave me. And whether that was true or not, I don't think it was actually true, but that's what my brain was saying. I was preparing to go back to the single life. I was like, this is going to suck so bad. I've got the narrative going, but I'm freaking out. I'm like, you know when you just get, when you're in that place of desperation and you know you've just buried yourself in just this self-imposed crisis, there's just a knot in your stomach. Like, I just feel like I'm this close to throwing up all the time. I'm just so soul sick when I'm in that place, and that's the place I was in. And the reality was is that was a position where I needed to stay for a while. That was a cocoon that I needed to be wrapped in to be transformed. And that was not a fun experience. Hindsight always being 20/20, it's like unbelievable what happened to me through that process to come out the other end and be what I'm intended to be, or at least a better version of it. Right? She didn't leave me. It wasn't even close. In fact, she never even considered it. I just thought that was what was happening. And I remember being on the phone with my sponsor, 10-stepping avidly, right? I mean, I was in so much spiritual pain, I was calling like daily at that point, just like, I'm delusional, I'm afraid, I'm dishonest, resentful with myself for creating this mess. And there was a time where the conclusion after the truth had all been brought to the table, you know, we bring those things to God, it looks like you have no choice but to just suffer. Really? That's the answer? Right? You have no choice but to suffer. And a lot of the time, that's it. Like, I don't get to decide what the outcome is of these things, right? What we're doing here is we're like mixing the ingredients of the spiritual cake together. We're getting it all situated. We're getting the ingredients together. We're putting it in a pan. We put it in the oven to bake, and we step away. We don't get to decide what the outcome is, right? And that drives me as an alcoholic absolutely insane. I want nothing more than to make sure that cake comes out the way I need it to enjoy it, right? But God, come to find out, is a much better baker than I am. God knows what that cake needs to look like, right? Obviously not a literal cake. Again, I'm a metaphor guy. I love pictures. It works for me. So to be in that place where I have absolutely no say in what happens in my life, to actually truly let go and be convinced that God is going to take care of me no matter what, that's not an easy place to be. I mean, we could sit here and say, oh yeah, no, let go and let God. I had a gentleman that I work with say that to me the other morning. I just need to let go and let God. And I laughed and I said, you don't actually believe that, right? Because in theory, that phrase sounds amazing. I need to let go and let God. If you're as nuts as I am, good luck, right? This is yours, God. I'm just giving it to you, right? And then I go back to managing it. That's usually what it looks like if we're being honest, right? Yeah, we still have to talk about the third step.
Yeah, I know we'll do it. We'll join it to the next one.
Okay. Anyway, so, you know, building on that, again, we're building the structure, right? The desperation is necessary. And I say that because it's so, even first trip through the steps, 20th trip through the steps, there's always opportunity to identify in the second portion of that first step, where is it that I'm still not trusting God? Am I all in? Am I all in? Have I completely given my life to God? My freedom comes with chains, right? That's one of the scariest propositions I was given. And I resisted it first. It's like, there is no way. That sounds so restricting and debilitating. My freedom doesn't come with chains. My freedom is freedom. You know, I'm fighting for my right to do what I want to do and feel good. I don't know about any of you, but if I'm being honest with myself, when the dust settles, a lot of the time when I'm doing things, really what it comes down to is when I'm behaving in a way that's objectionable to me and in my soul and my gut and my heart, I inevitably pay for that freedom with price tags that I just can't sustain, right? It just sucks the life, the being, the will right out of me. And then I'm hanging on to my freedom, right? So for me, what that really means is my freedom, my true freedom in God, comes with chains that I have to do this stuff. I have to do what we do here. I have to be vigilant, and I have to be continually examining my life to be all in. I mean, I can't have freedom as it's understood in a lot of circles, right? I need, again, discipline. I need opportunities continuously to experience vulnerability and to be able to consider that proposition. Is God everything? Is God everything? Do I even want God to be everything? Or am I still going to try to spin these plates like the chimp until it just all comes crashing down, right? I usually need to get to a pretty blunt end before I'm willing to move, unfortunately. But the good news is that we have the opportunity to continually be there. If we're willing, again, to be honest with ourselves, that's the most important part. Nobody can make this second step decision for me, right? Nobody can say, all right, Nate, you're all in with God. Ready? Sure. Right? I mean, whenever you ask anybody that's brand new, are you willing to go to any lengths? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yep. And then you finally figure out what that is, and it's like, maybe I spoke a little too soon, right? So, anyway, thanks.
All right, thank you, Nate. We're going to get back together now at 11:25. Why don't we do that? Just take a break till 11:25.
Do 3 and 4.